from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Vaseli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll chat with members of the Icarus Jazz Ensemble.
I'll talk with Christopher West about a contemporary art auction and show he's planning with Mindy Taylor Ross.
And I'll talk with Rita Kahn and Ron Spencer about Rita's new play, Before the Shadows Flee. Plus, there's our arts calendar we call What Do We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Members of the Icarus Ensemble are all regular players with Indianapolis Symphony and other local groups, as well as being active educators. They play a broad mix of music from classically inspired jazz to jazz and pop standards to original compositions written by group members. On Monday, May 24th, they're playing their third gig at South Broad Ripple's venerable venue, the Jazz Kitchen. And Sharon Gamble invited violinist Dean Franca, bassist Peter Hansen, and wind player Mark Artwine in to find out what makes this ensemble tick.
All right, so the theme of today's conversation is versatility. We have classical musicians who also play Broadway shows, who also play jazz and often write and arrange. But we also have someone in the room who plays how many instruments? Mark?
Well, I play all the woodwinds except oboeing and English horn. I will not touch those.
Why?
Because they're evil instruments. Right?
wait a minute. Okay, so anybody who's attempted to play one of those instruments, one wind instrument, is going to say, that's not natural. How did you possibly get in a position to acquire all those skills?
Well, I grew up in Las Vegas, and at that time, there was lots of work for doublers. So especially people who played flute, clarinet, and saxophone could work. All the hotels still had shows, like Frank Sinatra was still there quite a bit, and used show orchestras. And anybody who can play oboe or bassoon would even have a bigger leg up. And so I started on saxophone and added bassoon and then flute and clarinet later. And I thought about oboe, but bassoon and oboe are different animals from any of the other woodwinds, because we have to make our own reeds and have to adjust our own reeds. And
I used to date a bassoonist, and the time he didn't spend rehearsing, he spent making reeds.
Yes, we don't.
That was it. There was nothing else. There was nothing else in life.
We don't practice either. We just make reeds.
Yeah.
It's really a terrible life. And so the thought of adding oboe also was too much. So
put you over the edge.
Yes. And oboe players are crazy. They are.
You better defend that. We might have one or two listening. Why?
Oboes are even worse than bassoon, because they usually have to make their reeds the day of the performance, and they last like 1 or 2 days, and that's the end of it. And as bassoonists, we do a longer process, and our reeds last much longer, so we're much more stable people.
It's a good thing this is radio, and you can't see the looks on the string players in the room. Table compared to what they're saying. Little thought balloons. So the commonality, Dean Franca, Peter Hansen, Mark Artwine, the commonality in the room is the ISO, playing with, subbing with, being an extra in. And at what point did you all realize, hey, we could be partners in crime in the jazz scene? How did that start?
Well,
Peter, are you the ringleader on that?
Yeah, Gary Walters and I had hooked up on some Chaz Carter, Gene Markowitz quartet gigs. Gary playing piano, I was subbing on bass for Fred Withrow, and we hit it off pretty well. And especially I hit it off with Chaz Carter, the leader of that group, and he was always into getting together to read some charts of this group that I always loved named Oregon. And we always talked amongst the three of us, Gary, Chaz, and I, about putting together a group. Well, Chaz, unfortunately, passed away a number of years ago, but Gary and I sort of kept the conversation going of trying to start up a group. And Dean and I have always been playing together, playing jazz together for since he moved into my neighborhood, you know, 20 years ago, I think. And we've always enjoyed that. And Mark kind of lives in the bass room at the ISO, being that he's the contrabassoon player in the orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to be around Mark long to know that he's a brilliant jazz musician as well as being a brilliant classical musician. So it just seemed like the synergy was really good to put something together that we could do some standards, some original compositions, and sort of continue the dream that Chaz Carter kind of instilled in Gary and I.
And Dean, your attraction to jazz or to this particular ensemble?
Oh, wow. Well,
three-fifths of which we have in the room. Am I doing the right fractions?
That's right. Okay. Besides Gary Walters, you mentioned Peter, John Crabiel, our percussionist, is also not represented here, but here in the room. But, yes, we're all five of us in Icarus. And, how did I get started in jazz? Well, I guess when I was a teenager, I had a half-brother who was much, much older than I was, and he was always roaming around, kind of an eccentric guy. And he had a wonderful record collection. He used to work in a pretty high-end book record store in Toronto. And he was a well-trained pianist, classical pianist, but he had a great record collection, including some old 45 RPMs. For those of you out there that are younger than 35, those were like LPs, which were like giant CDs, only they were small, closer to the size of CDs. And now that you're totally confused, I'll just mention that there are a lot of Louis Armstrong LPs, and that name will probably sound more familiar than old 45s. Anyway, just great jazz playing and you know, playing the trumpet as if they were just singing, and you didn't even hear the trumpet, you just heard somebody singing. And so I was really excited by that. And then my dad was a big jazz fan. He didn't really know anything about jazz. He played piano by ear, and he was a fanatic about classical music. He was, you know, European born and raised, and from Germany. And I guess in Germany at the time that he was growing up, classical music was a huge part of people's lives, just your average person's life. And it was part of his, even though his upbringing was, you know, he was very poor when he was raised in the Depression. But his father was an electrical engineer.
Hmm.
And his father showed him how to build a radio. And that was the kind of projects that they did when they were little. And, of course, when you put on a radio, one of the first things you heard in that time, and it was the latest craze, was jazz. And so my dad was totally swept away by that. And I think I was influenced by it. I had, but my primary interest was violin. And a lot of people don't think of the violin primarily as a jazz instrument, and they'd probably be right for that to be the case. Fortunately, there's a few of the crazy people that, you know, still think a violin can sound really cool in jazz. So I had a lot of Stefan Grappelli records. You know, he was this French violinist who had some classical training, had a fantastic bow arm, and a really seductive way of playing rhythmically.
And famous for those fast, like show-stopping fast passages.
Yes, that's definitely true. And nowadays you have a lot of people that are equally fast in that department, and that's really exciting. I think there's a lot more cool violin playing in jazz that's accessible to people. I guess I'm saying accessible because in the old days, if you found an LP, you could listen, or if you're lucky, something came across on the radio. Now you can get on YouTube and hear a jazz violinist from Finland. You can hear a jazz string quartet from San Francisco. You can hear all this stuff. So now it's even a more exciting time, I think, for what used to be maybe more of a niche, I guess, or a niche, if we're in France still with Stefan Grappelli,
You know, it's an exciting time to be a musician in terms of what the technology has opened up.
Peter, did you have parents who were nudging you towards music?
Well, my parents just loved music. My dad had an incredible record collection of all sorts of things. I have a lot of it now. And, you know, Broadway shows, but classical pieces. I mean, my first exposure to classical music was probably coming from home from a camp where we'd done Beethoven's Eroica. And, you know, lo and behold, my dad had a great recording of it. And, yeah, so they were just big fans. They both played piano. Big fans of all kinds of music, so it wasn't hard to get swept up in music. But I was primarily really taken with rock and roll when I was first starting in music. So
was your first instrument bass?
No.
I was guessing not. Was it guitar?
Guitar, piano and guitar. Uh-huh. And then the fifth grade instrument was violin. And then by the time I was 13, sitting in the violin section and looking over at the bass section in junior high school, I've been thinking, man, those guys look like they're having a good time. That was pretty much it. And wanted to try the bass, and yeah, I've loved the bass ever since. But still enjoy playing guitar, playing piano, do a lot of composing at those instruments as well as at the bass. So.
And Mark? Your parents were musicians or just appreciative of music?
My dad actually was quite a good singer. He's and he still does lots of things in Las Vegas. So I got a lot of out of listening, I think, to him, because I got to hear him just about every Sunday and singing at church and things. He was a song leader. And my mother played violin just in high school. But I went to a summer camp. They sent me to a summer camp, I think, after my fifth grade year. And I had already been playing piano, actually, private lessons on piano. And I got to try everything, all the instruments. And I was sure, going into it, I was sure I was going to be a trumpet player.
Really?
I still probably want to be a trumpet. I love
stop.
I know, like Maynard Ferguson stuff. I love, especially like a real great lead trumpet player. But I tried everything, and the saxophone, I just love the saxophone. So I started playing the saxophone in sixth grade, and I think seventh grade I started studying privately, and my teacher, again, was a guy who played shows on the Strip and was a great jazz player, and so really got hooked from then.
For anyone who's paying attention, there's kind of a soft spot year here, somewhere around fifth or sixth grade, where your life can be changed forever just by looking across at that other instrument, going to camp, looking through an old record collection, or depending on your age, an old MP3 collection, I suppose it might be. So obviously you guys and your colleagues who aren't represented in the room have full-time careers. You know, most of you are full-time players in the ISO, which doesn't leave a lot of extra time, although I know you all are from time to time fitting in studio, recording studio work. How do you carve out time, and how do you approach a jazz rehearsal differently than you might a classical rehearsal? Not sure who's going to be the first person to answer on this. Or maybe there isn't any difference. Maybe it's just technique and it doesn't matter.
Carving out time to do it is difficult, but we've recently become a little bit more disciplined about actually sitting down with calendars and saying, we're going to rehearse these times in the next month, and, you know, just making it work. As far as the approach to the rehearsing, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I haven't got an idea. Since with this group especially, so much of it is composition-based that we are bringing to the table, for me, that's whenever we have a rehearsal, I kind of get in gear and it's like, oh boy, I better write something.
Or that's, you know, that's a big difference.
Or even something I already wrote, you know, there's something I want to do differently. And so, so it's definitely a different preparation And
and you listen with different ears, don't you? When you've written a chart and you've agonized over a voicing or rhythm here or whether dynamics or the number of bars even or something, and then so you listen. It's not like you're playing that Beethoven symphony and it's already all printed out and there's
and
one
you've played
final
it many
version
times before.
And that too, yeah.
Now, you guys all write and or arrange. When you do that, are you thinking of your colleagues in this ensemble, or is it more academic, for want of a better word? Is it more, well, the violin line could do this here, or is it more, Dean's really great when he does this kind of riff, so let's write this for him? Which way do you go?
Wow. It's a little bit of both, I guess. Like some of the things that I've I've actually written before, but then I rearranged it, and I thought, man, this will sound really cool with bassoon and violin. And so then I write it in that, with that in mind, not specifically Dean, because whatever I write, he can play, so, which is true. I think in the future, the more I write, the more I'm going to be thinking specifically about who's in the group.
Mm-hmm.
And like John Crabiel is a great percussionist as well as a drum set player. So I have some things in mind that I really want him to do more percussion type stuff or like African percussion stuff that he really knows about.
Yeah, if I might step in, I think that's really so, Mark, that we're writing the music, and sometimes it's an arrangement, sometimes it's an original piece, but we do hear each other's playing in our ear. I think you were sort of hinting at that, Sharon, that, oh, yeah, well, I can hear this Mark's incredible sound there, or Peter's fantastic, passage work there, or that beautiful, soulful thing, or whatever, or Gary this and John that. The thing is, too, that are so confident in each other's playing, I guess, as a group, that it really frees you up to write. It would be different if you had a group where you felt like, oh, well, gee, that person only plays well in that range or something. Here, let me give you an example of that. I wrote this tune, and I thought, oh, Mark, this will sound so good. Mark plays this. You know, it's got leaps and stuff, and, you know, it'll be just fantastic on the saxophone. So I wrote it, and I gave it to him, and he said, oh, well, saxophone doesn't go down, down this low, that particular instrument, and I wanted it. And he says, no problem, I'll just play it an octave up. it was up in the stratosphere, and he just tossed it off, no problem, you know. So it really frees you up to write whatever you want for the group, and that's kind of a great thing for a composer to have.
Why Icarus?
One of the first tunes we did was a tune that the Paul Winter Consort had done and the group Oregon had done as a Ralph Towner composition called Icarus. And, we really enjoyed playing it. We kind of coupled it with another piece. And we didn't have a whole lot of debates about using that as a name for the group. It just seemed kind of natural.
You took flight from there.
That's right.
Sharon Gamble with violinist Dean Franca, bassist Peter Hansen, and wind player Mark Ortwine of Icarus. John Crable, percussion, and Gary Walters, piano, are the other members. And the Icarus Ensemble will be returning to the Jazz Kitchen on Monday, May 24th from 6:30 to 10 p.m. Find out more at thejazzkitchen.com. And here's a sample of what you'll hear that night.
Listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Two of the most important players in bringing contemporary art to Indianapolis over the past few years are Mindy Taylor Ross and Christopher West. And now they are teaming up to bring it here and then auction it off for what they plan will be the first in a series of contemporary art auctions. To do this, they're partnering with Ripley's Auction House and will be raising money for the Contemporary Art Acquisition Fund at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. Travis DiNicola spoke with Christopher West to find out more.
Christopher, welcome back to Art of the Matter.
It's good to be back, Travis. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Always great to have you here. Talking about contemporary art, your partner in crime with this, Mindy Taylor Ross, couldn't join us today, but the two of you have been working on this new project for a while, which is pretty exciting. I mean, just when I just first heard that you and Mindy were coming together, I mean, Mindy has been involved in many different contemporary art projects, public art projects, the work you've done with IMOCA, and now Christopher West Presents. The idea of the two of you working together, I figure it's got to be good.
Well, Mindy and I, from pretty much the moment we first met, you know, hit it off.
Mm-hmm.
We felt like kind of kindred spirits trying to bring some exciting work to this town and really focus on contemporary art and how great that could be. And at a time 5-6 years ago when it seemed to not have a whole lot of attention going on.
Mm-hmm.
So Mindy and I have been kindred spirits for quite a while.
Now, where did the idea come from to do an art auction? Because honestly, you know, is the economy is not that much better yet, is it? Or you guys are pretty optimistic?
Well, of course we're optimistic. No, I mean, the economy is not fantastic. But what we're really focusing on and what we recognized when we've been sitting down and chatting over the past year or so
mm-hmm.
is that partly because of the economy, there's not a whole lot of outlets for artists to try to sell their works.
Mm-hmm.
There's still plenty of great artists here making work.
Right.
There's some great nonprofit spaces and some smaller artist-run spaces that are showing really good stuff. But as far as like a commercial corridor where you have, you know, a handful of galleries open on the regular schedule trying to sell
mm-hmm.
work, those have been drying up, and we all know some of those sad stories.
Yeah, unfortunately, we've lost a couple of great galleries
just
in the past year or so, you know, with Rushman and J.C. Lucas. But this is a little bit different. I mean, it's not actually a gallery show. It's an auction show. Or describe to me how you envision this. I mean, what exactly is going to happen here? Because you're getting work submitted by contemporary artists, not just in Indianapolis, but from all across the country as well.
It's primarily focused around our artists here locally. There are some other works, artists from New York, Louisville, Cincinnati. You know, we are pulling from some other places.
Okay.
But the focus, especially for this first one, is we're trying to get our feet wet. Has been really trying to promote and distribute some of the work of some of the local artists at a caliber that's on par with the work that we're bringing in from other places.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also doing consigning some work from individual collectors as well.
Okay.
That are refocusing their collection or moving on to different things. So.
Now, is this is there a theme, if you will, to this, or is it more like a Sotheby's type of auction of just like contemporary art that happens to be on the market?
There's no thematic restrictions other than contemporary art and design.
Okay.
And it's kind of fun coming at it for me. I've always been fascinated with the auction houses with Sotheby's and Christie's, and
mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're a fan of the gallery on Facebook. I often post these ridiculous auction results about the new Picasso getting $106 million.
Yeah, just broke every record over Giacometti's.
Last week, yeah. So it's been an area or a subject that's fascinated me for a long time. And coming at it from this perspective, kind of strictly market-driven, without trying to come up with a theme, has been really interesting, and having to kind of change the thought process a little bit, and it's I'm learning a lot doing this. It's a lot of work.
And this is a very different part of the art world as well for both you and Mindy, essentially, to be working. I mean, you've both been involved in, you know, bringing artists here, but to get involved in this, so much of the commercial side, the auction side, the selling side, it's something that we often associate just with, you know, either London or New York, perhaps Los Angeles. You know, it's certainly much rarer to have a contemporary art auction going on in Indianapolis.
And I think working with Dan Ripley, Antique Helper, is the auction house that's handling this, we're really trying to handle it like a New York or London auction. I don't think you'll see a $106 million Picasso there, unfortunately. but that's the attitude we're taking. And the way Dan Ripley does it, completely professional. He's curated some great shows for Wright Auctions up in Chicago, as well as his auction house here that has just been highly professional and amazingly done. And that's really the caliber that we're trying to bring to Indianapolis.
Tell me what it is if you can. I mean, what's so fascinating about this side of the art world? I mean, there's certainly a glamorous side to it. When you hear about, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars going for a Picasso and stuff, obviously the economy's doing well for somebody. Or even on other levels, though, the idea of auctioning off work as opposed to just, you know, walking into a gallery and seeing a price tag. I mean, there's a whole different element here to it.
There is, and that's one of our goals, is to create more of a culture of buying here in this town, to let people know that it's okay to buy contemporary artwork and live with things that might just not be a pretty picture above your couch. Mm-hmm. So since I've gone to the market side and I opened my gallery last year, it's been kind of interesting to see people's reactions and that they can purchase this installation art or this video art or this highly conceptual photography, that is something that they can live with. So trying to help change the culture here a little bit, that's okay, that's one of our goals too. It seems that when I was running the numbers not too long ago, I was selling a lot more to New York and to California than I am here locally.
Really?
Which isn't totally unexpected, but really want to teach people here that that's okay too. They can own some of this work that they might not consider otherwise.
Can you give us a preview as far as what some of the work on auction is going to include, or some of the artists?
It's going to be, again, unlike a curated show in a museum or a gallery, it's going to be kind of all over the board, which makes it exciting too. There's paintings, sculpture, photography, some great furniture design, studio furniture by some wonderful studio artists here in town, too. So it's going to be a little bit of a mixture of everything. A lot of names you've heard of, some you probably haven't heard of, but really exciting work.
Will there be an online catalog available?
There'll be an online catalog. We're also going to be printing a catalog as well.
And is that through Ripley's Auction?
Exactly, yeah. AntiqueHelper.com is the address there. We should have the online catalog available a couple weeks before the auction, and then the actual catalog, physical catalog.
The auction is going to take place in June.
June 25th, yes.
June 25th, and it will be at Ripley's.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's located where?
It's about 55th and Rural. I might be getting the address a little bit wrong there, but just east of Keystone, up there kind of by the post office.
But again, antiquehelper.com is where all the information is. Of course, get the address and all that sort of stuff from there.
Yes, and the auction again on the 25th, and we'll be having a big preview party on that Thursday, the 24th, the day before. So that might be a good idea to come hang out with the work and get a little idea after seeing it online what it's really about. So.
What sort of response, Christopher, have you been getting from local artists for doing something like this? Since it is, you know, a new way of showing their work, a new way of selling their work, really, here in Indy.
The response has been fantastic. We actually had to push the auction back a few weeks because we were getting so many submissions.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really wanted to concentrate on making some edits and putting the best possible work out there. So we've been really excited about the response here.
What about a response from potential buyers? Have you been hearing from some of them as well?
Yeah, we've got people excited. There's a portion of the proceeds are going to the IMA Contemporary Art Acquisition Fund.
Yeah, that's a great thing. So this is actually, I mean, even though you're obviously selling work to help the artists and there's commissions and all that sort of stuff, but you're also raising money for the IMA.
It was important to us from the very beginning to have some sort of charitable component. And for this first one, the IMA seemed like the most logical step. And again, the hope is this becomes an annual or semi-annual event, and in which case, you know, it could benefit different organizations throughout the city or art criticism or, you know, other smaller nonprofits. So that's been getting some of the potential buyers excited, too, that they can have some really exciting artwork and there's proceeds going to a very reputable organization.
Now, I know you said that you don't expect many works to be selling for the $100 million range, but what do you think the range is going to be? I mean, is there going to be some affordable work there as well mixed in? Is this really only for serious collectors, or who do you see as the audience for
this? It's going to be quite a mixture, and that's been one of the fun things about putting this together, too. There'll be works there from, you know, a few $100s, a couple $100s, you know, up into the thousands. So it's going to be a broad range. We're excited about generating the buzz and getting, you know, some of the seasoned collectors there as well as maybe a new generation of collectors. I think there'll be something for everyone.
Any advice for those new collectors as far as what to look for?
Well, you got to follow your heart. And what I would do is I would come to the preview on that Thursday on the 24th and look at everything there, go to bed, and think about it. And when you wake up the next morning, if there's a piece or two that kind of sticks in your head that makes you stop and think, then then those might be the ones that you might want to go after.
Excellent, excellent. Now, will I be able to call in and be the anonymous bidder?
We will accept phone bids. You can also bid online. Yeah, okay. We do it all. So I know you're a very discerning collector, Travis. You don't want everyone to
Well, you know, I get shot sometimes. So sometimes better heard and not seen. So Christopher West, thank you so much. Really looking forward to this art auction that you and Mindy Taylor-Ross are putting on together, and also looking forward to seeing the next show Christopher West presents down on Mass Avenue as well. What do you got coming up for us there?
We're going to be doing a great installation by Ted Ross. He just got his MFA from Heron in furniture design. So excited to bring his work over to Mass Ave. He's doing some really exciting things.
Great. Looking forward to that, too. Christopher, thanks so much.
Absolutely.
Travis DiNicola with curator Christopher West. The first contemporary art auction takes place on June 25th. For more information, visit antiquehelper.com, antiquehelper.com. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
I'll bet you also have friends whose kids are getting out of school right about now for the summer, and they're already saying, Mom, what do I want to do? Dad, I'm bored. And I have just the thing to take your kids to, although if you're a grown-up, you can go without the benefit of children, on today's calendar that we call What Will We Do?
Go right ahead.
Well, what we will do is play with the world's largest, are you ready for this? This is so cool. Etch-a-Sketch.
That is super
cool. Did you read about
this? It takes like two people, right?
It takes two people to operate. Now, when I said Etch-a-Sketch, if you pictured that thing that was easy to hold in your lap, it's about the size of a modern netbook, 9 inches, 7 inches, and you shake it to erase your drawing. Well, picture that on steroids, because this thing is more than 8 feet tall and has a 6 foot wide screen, and it takes two people to turn the knobs. Don't worry, you don't have to pick it up and shake it when you want to do a new drawing. There's a motor that does that. But it's on view now at the Children's Museum, and you know, you can go play with it at your will, and you do not require a child to play with the Etch-a-Sketch, so I'm just saying.
Very cool. You know, it's some of the most entertaining and engaging ideas we get for our calendar, we get from the website. When people go to WFYI.org and go to local programs and Art of the Matter, and there's a place there where you can submit ideas for our calendar. This is one of my favorites this week.
Right.
On June 6th, the Swedish American Club, known as Vasa, is hosting the North American Viking event, which will show skills from the Viking Age, including combat, cooking, games, textile crafts, and woodworking.
You're making this
up. I am not making this up. It's taking place at the Latvian Club at 1008 West 64th Street. The public is welcome. Again, June 6th. I would just Google the Viking Swedish American Club event for more information.
How cool is that? Practice your mace throwing out in a big field, though, please. Yeah. Don't do that in tight quarters. Indianapolis Civic Theater is having auditions for a fabulous show, The Belle of Amherst, the story of Emily Dickinson's life. And they're looking for one woman for the passionate role of poet Emily Dickinson. Auditions will be scheduled by appointment only. You need to contact Civic Theater to do that, michael@civictheater.org. And the auditions will be happening on Monday, June 7th, and Tuesday, June 8th, in the evening at the Marion University Campus Theater, which is where Indianapolis Civic is currently housed. So if you fit the qualifications and love Emily Dickinson and have some acting chops, contact michael@civictheater.org.
The last concert of the season is coming up at Meridian Music up in Carmel on May 24th, 7 p.m., and it is featuring a piano quintet by Dvorak. And this is the last of their spring concert series. Admission is $8, again, 7 p.m. on the 24th at Meridian Music.
I have something else for you to take your kids to. The Art Museum of Greater Lafayette is currently having an exhibit of the original cover art from the Saturday Evening Post from the 1950s and early 1960s, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, kids probably haven't, even though it's still published, most younger people haven't seen Saturday Evening Post. But if you have kids who are interested in history or want to know what it was like when Grandma and Grandpa were little, this is something worth taking them to. That opens May 21st and runs through September 11th, so you have a little bit of time to see it. But
so
great,
Norman
great
Rockwell
little road trip.
And other artists, and they're showing each original with the original cover, too.
Right, right.
Very neat.
Very fun.
Hey, Pictures at an Exhibition is going on this weekend. Dance Kaleidoscope is performing at the Indiana Repertory Theater. So performances at 8 o'clock Saturday night. And 2:30 Sunday are the last performances at the IRT. You can get more information at dancecal.org for pictures at an exhibition.
Indiana Landmarks, formerly Historic Landmarks, is at it again. They're doing their Back to the Future and Mid-Century Modern Home Tour, which turns the spotlight on Evans Woolens designs, the nationally and even internationally renowned Indiana and Indianapolis native Evans Woolen, known for amazing modernist buildings that he started creating, designing many, many years ago. We won't date him by saying how long ago. But you can see a great sampling of them on the Mid-Century Modern Back to the Future tour. And that tour goes on June 5th. And you can find out more by Googling IndianaLandmarks.org to find out how to attend that tour.
And the last thing I have is the Indiana Wind Symphony featuring Hoosier composers has a concert this Sunday, the 23rd at 7:30 p.m. at the Zionsville Performing Arts Center. And among the different pieces they are performing is Begin the Begin, Cole Porter's great piece, on the occasion of the 100th birthday of clarinetist and band leader Artie Shaw. Should be very fun. Again, this is 7:30 on Sunday night at Zionsville Performing Arts Center.
And they appreciate your tooting their horn, Indiana Wind Symphony. You know what? We have lots more things to see and do, to take your kids to or to go to entertain yourself, but that's about all the time we have on today's calendar we call What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.
What would it be like to be the sibling or spouse or parent of someone who committed a crime so heinous that your relative's name is ever after famous for all the wrong reasons? Rita Kahn has been haunted by that question and by the life of the actor Edwin Booth for a quarter of a century. She's created a play called Before the Shadows Flee that explores the life of Edwin Booth, who will be played by Ron Spencer in a production at the Indiana State Museum. Rita and Ron told Sharon Gamble more during a recent visit. Ron begins with an excerpt.
Not long ago, I told Lawrence Barrett that I was studying Claudius and would like to try my hand at it someday. I fancy it is full of subtlety and affords scope for quiet but intense emotion. I told Larry I must try Claudius someday. And can you, by no drift of circumstance, get from him why he puts on this confusion, grating so harshly all his days of quiet with turbulent and dangerous lunacy? And can you, by no drift of circumstance, get from him why he puts on this confusion, grating so harshly all his days of quiet with turbulent and dangerous lunacy? And can you, by no drift of circumstance, get from him why he puts on this confusion, grating so harshly all his days of quiet with turbulent and dangerous lunacy? Oh, 'tis too true. How smart a lash that speech doth give my conscience. The harlot's cheek, beautied with plastering art, is not more ugly to the thing that helps it than is my word to my most painted deed. Oh, heavy burden. Claudius has a conscience. But where was that conscience when he committed the foul deed? Was it jealousy for power, unrequited love for the queen, or sheer madness of the moment? Oh, how different would my life have been these 26 years if John... It never leaves me.
I love, love, love this, because if you say Booth to a theater person, they know you mean Edwin. If you say Booth to anybody else, they know you mean, John Wilkes Booth. Rita, what inspired you to write this?
This play has been part of me for a very long time, and it actually goes back to the Phoenix Theater in 1983 when we first did Necessities. That Phoenix Theater launched my playwriting career as part of the Festival of Emerging American Theater. And I had, of course, been researching that period, and it is the time of Louisa May Alcott, who wrote in her journal how magnificent it was to experience Edwin Booth.
Really?
Prior to my coming to Indianapolis, I had been working with theater in Normal, Illinois, and was aware that the newer generation coming up was Edwin Booth who?
Mm-hmm.
And here was the man who gave us the opening to the method, the quieter acting style, as opposed to the bombastic style.
Which we heard in this excerpt.
Early part of the 19th century.
Yeah.
And so this play has been with me for a quarter of a century. And this was an opportunity now to bring it forward in connection with the Lincoln commemorations that are going on here. And because one doesn't always find the physicality or the temperament or the acumen of an actor like Ron Spencer to be able to bring that part forward. And so it was a confluence of good luck that the Indiana State Museum, through the work of David McDaniel, who understands the way that theater needs to connect with us on every level. And so he was eager to bring this play forward through their fourth annual Fine Arts Festival at the Indiana State Museum. And so, you know, the stars were right for this. And our hope is that we will bring forward Edwin's story to a new generation. But it's a play that reaches us on so many different levels because it's a play about theater and theater people. It's a play about social events. It's a play about family. And it's a play about a person's struggle with himself, with outer forces, and yet who wanted so much to give back, and with some premonition on his part, he says in 1891, when the 100 years roll around, I do not believe the name of Edwin Booth will be up there.
Mm.
And, you know, how true.
Interestingly enough, Sharon, I think what she's saying about the individual here is critical, too, because many of us suffer tragedies throughout our lives. I've suffered some personal tragedy. My mother died in my arms. I had a little 11-year-old nephew who was killed by a truck. And, you know, we survived those things. But can you imagine at that time being in the public eye? Your business is being in front of the public and involved with the public, and having your younger, more popular brother assassinate one of the most beloved characters and presidents in the history of the United States.
No, I can't imagine. And that's why it's so intriguing, too, that, you know, Edwin Booth is so associated with the character of Hamlet, who has this problem, too, that this horror has happened in his family, and he's not the cause of it, but he needs to do something about it.
Exactly. Rita was kind enough to compare me to Edwin Booth on some levels, which I greatly appreciate, because having worked on this piece now for 3 weeks and getting ready to open, I admire the man so much, and it really means a great deal to me personally. After our rehearsals of late, Rita's been saying, "You are feeling him. I can tell
you are channeling him.
It's an amazing story of a pretty remarkable man.
Ron, my sense of you is that you called for a line about 3 minutes after you were born, so you've grown up in theater. Is that right?
It is right. Okay. I started out in such high-profile establishments as the Masonic Lodge and the 4-H Club and the state fairs and the little grade school productions and all that.
Do you remember when you first read about Edwin Booth or became aware of him?
Actually, it was probably when I was about 10 years old, I think, ironically enough, because there was a film that was made called Prince of Players with Richard Burton, written by Moss Hart, based on a book. And the movie was not very successful.
Richard Burton as Edwin Booth?
Richard Burton as Edwin Booth.
Cool.
Yeah, amazing. They said he was particularly effective, of course, in the Shakespearean passages.
Sure.
I love Richard Burton, but it always bothered me that he never sounded American enough for me. Fortunately, since I'm playing an American, I don't have to try to sound like a Brit.
Mm.
You know, I can play Edwin Booth as a unique American individual actor. So, but it was probably along about 10, 12 years old that I first heard of it. But it still didn't ring true. It rang true, but it didn't register with me the significance of what this man had done. Like Rita said, he is the father, in effect, of method acting.
Yeah.
One of the speeches about his wife says, Mary told me that I should find my own style, encourage me to find my own style, one quieter than yours, referring to his father. not as great, perhaps, and not as memorable.
Mm.
But she was not very fond of French comedies were coming along about that time, the bawdy French comedies with the wild, you know, overacting.
Really broad.
Really broad type comedies. Yeah. And she was not at all fond of those. She was a devotee of tragedy, and she even says, if the great tragedies are to remain, a new style of acting had to be studied. And she says to her husband, "You can, if you will, change the perverted taste of the public with your truth and sublimity. Is it not outrageous to see so holy an art as the drama desecrated?"
Everyone should have such a muse.
Oh, I agree.
What a strong.
Unfortunately, she was not with him nearly long enough, mm. although obviously she stayed with him in memory all of his life, because he truly loved Mary Devlin.
And what's happening, Rita, set the scene for us. There's an interior monologue as Edwin is checking out the stage before a performance of Hamlet.
Yeah,
right?
You know, the play itself takes place just before he goes on stage to do Hamlet at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And it takes place in 1891. And Edwin has been badgered by the critics. He's 57 years old, and he's still playing a 19-year-old prince.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not been well. And he does what all of us do as actors. We go out on the stage before the play, and we kind of, you know, check it out. And he's, this interior monologue, he's ruminating, must I quit acting? You know, if I cannot do the parts well, must I quit acting? And all of this bubbles up. Now, yes, the play itself is, I said it, but everything said in the play comes from his diaries, letters, journals, newspaper clippings. I didn't make anything up.
Hmm.
Not a speech in here is made up. It's borrowed, lifted, taken.
Assembled.
From the public record of who he was as a person. And therefore, the language is almost Shakespearean.
Absolutely. It's beautiful. I find myself just being almost lulled into the character by
elegant.
The sound of the very elegant speech, and yet contemporary enough that it's really going to speak to today's audience. You know, because people are people, no matter what era they lived in, and I see his humor and humanity throughout this piece. So there are a lot of opportunities to connect with the audience.
What surprised either of you? What did you learn about Edwin Booth that you hadn't known?
Oh, so much.
Well, you know, for me, when I first began the research, the definitive research, this has been going on for 25
right, right.
years.
Right, right. It's a long gestation period.
You know, I'm not exactly what you call a fast study, but sometimes it takes that long for something to materialize as it should be for the time to come. And what I learned from all this is that a story tells itself when it needs to be told.
Mm.
And that Edwin and Hamlet are so close in that when he speaks to Horatio and he says, you know, stop thinking of yourself for a little bit there and think of the greater part here and tell my story.
Playwright Rita Kahn and actor Ron Spencer. You can see Ron as Edwin Booth in Before the Shadows Flee at the Indiana State Museum. For more information, visit indianamuseum.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 p.m. when I find out about the Indiana Handicraft Exchange.
I get to take a garden walk.
And I'll get a preview of what Eagle Creek Park is offering this summer. And of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.